Good morning, everyone. This is Chandra Dasa from the Buddhist Centre Online here in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, in the USA. Sadly, for the last of our planned podcasts, looking at the stages of the loving kindness meditation, the Metta Bhavana, which people all over the world are focusing on this week as part of the online urban retreat. And we're at the final stage of the meditation today, which is equalising a sense of loving kindness for the people you've considered in the previous stages. So yourself, a good friend, someone you're kind of neutral to, and someone you have difficulty with, or an enemy. And having equalised that, the idea is then to extend that sense of, you know, strong well-wishing and a sort of clear-eyed desire for people's welfare as widely as you can. And of course, the wider trick is to do that in a way that's both realistic and grounded, but also open-hearted and that can hold an ideal without becoming ideological about it. So we have our wonderful podcast gang together for the last time. We might sneak back in and do some more at another point, but for now, on my left, we have Kathy, we have Bob, and Robin, and Betty. Good morning, world.
Good morning, world.
So here we are. This is the end, my friend, as somebody once said or sang. And I suppose it's an expansive stage, isn't it? It's an expansive stage of practice. Visantra, in his talk about this, he did evoke that very beautifully, the kind of realistic connection with all living beings that one can have without all living beings becoming a cliché or something that's hackneyed or fanciful. But he did make this lovely point at the start about make sure that when you're wishing well to all living beings, that actually includes real people. Specific living beings. Which I like. It made me laugh this morning when I heard that early. I winced.
Not just an abstraction.
Living beings are not. It's not an abstraction. It involves people who are suffering greatly. It involves people who are extremely happy. It involves people you don't like.
As well as mosquitoes.
As well as mosquitoes, that's right. Could you feel metta, deep, deep metta towards a mosquito as they feed?
No, but I try to think of all levels of life, and I think it's a really good reminder to remember people.
I did once get to a stage where I could let a mosquito feed on me, only once. In Spain, we'd been meditating for about 4 months by that point, and you know that tendency just to go,
yes.
You feel it, or that the awful terror when you hear that in your ear, that awful feeling. There was one day where it didn't happen. And I remember opening my eyes and looking down and seeing the little thing feeding and having a strong sense of like, oh, go on, son. Fill up.
Did that last the whole day?
It did last the whole day. It lasted from then on, actually, but the retreat finished quite soon afterwards, and I'm sure that disappeared quite
quickly. And you went home with malaria.
No, I didn't get home with malaria. I was blessed. I suppose it was very interesting because I would never have thought that I would. And now, you know, now if I hear a mosquito, I definitely have that same. Your body's on alert.
I found in Visantra's talk, one of the most beautiful things was him saying that often we kind of pull back from really looking at the suffering in the world to kind of protect ourselves. We feel we can't take it in. So we kind of skim over that. And he talked about how one way to deal with that is to realize that Buddhists everywhere are meditating on this and trying to relate to the suffering in the world. And so you're not alone. And I just thought that was such a beautiful thought.
Mm.
Because somehow if you do start to get specific, you know, about the suffering that's out there, it can take you to a very painful place.
Yeah.
And invite you to get to that more abstract level.
Hmm.
So.
Yeah, it's a good thought, isn't it? Not even just Buddhists, actually. There's a lot of
others as well.
Who will be.
So it really encouraged me today to, more than ever, sort of just try to focus on what feeling was being invoked inside and, you know, sort of monitor my internal state. Rather than think about things, I put my attention on the internal part.
How was the weather in there?
Well, you know, I was holding this idea of an open heart and what that would feel like. I mean, I can definitely feel my chest rising and falling. And there are moments when, you know, I feel great warmth towards the friend, and I can carry that over, thinking of looking in her eyes, and I can carry that over a little. But I have a ways to go to experience, you know, big open heart. At least I feel I do.
I think experiencing is the word, too, because I think it would be impossible to have big open heart all the time. If you've experienced it once or twice, then you know it's there. And if it was open like that all the time, it would be, it'd be blown to bits. Blown, I mean, just destroyed, I think. But maybe that's just a habit of protection that I have.
I suppose if you could sustain the positivity. I don't think the metta that the Buddha's talking about is you being exposed or vulnerable in that way. I know what you mean when, you know, you sometimes you do just get opened up and you're not quite ready for it, or it's overwhelming. I think he's talking about something where, in a way, you are so, you're so deeply embedded into a way of seeing things that is open in all sorts of ways. In a way, there's probably no difference in the experience between the deep mindfulness that you can experience in yourself and the deep ease with which you move through the world and relate to everything that arises in your experience. It's just constantly opening out, because there isn't that constructed narrative going on all the time that is fixing you and fixing them and fixing that and fixing this. It's more like a whole fluid movement of being, at least as I understand it from what's been evoked. So I think it's maybe different from that sense of when the heart gets blown open, which it does.
Difference between an open heart and a bleeding heart, maybe.
I'm not sure, because I think a bleeding heart's a bit different. A bleeding heart can be a bit...
Painful
and... Depleting. I don't know, has anybody else got a, what would be the difference? Something.
Well, one word you used I thought struck me, which is ease. And I think that's what came to me a little bit at the end, was that this was about ease with what's out there. And so openness and being easy with reality in a way.
It's almost like a kind of even-heartedness. It's open, but there's an evening going on. It's like everything's okay, everything's eased.
Yeah, and then at the end of the transference of merit, we talked about as long as all have not attained to peace, and that kind of brought that back to me. I mean, that's what, in a way, you know, you can't make people's aging or illness or anything like that go away. So in the way, what you're really wishing for them is peace, making peace with what is. So in a way, I guess, once you make peace with what is, then that's maybe open-heartedness. And
well, it's certainly a basis, isn't it, where you can really develop something.
Like, yeah, maybe so.
What's that phrase, the peace that passeth beyond all understanding? I mean, yeah, in a way, that's where that would presumably go, once you've established a real grounding in ease,
yeah,
in reality. Your opportunities feel different. Your meetings feel different.
That would be the approach to avoid compassion fatigue, call it. Well, a bleeding heart, to me, connotates hurting for other people and trying to somehow make it right for them, or the animals, or the trees, or whatever, which leads to burnout, compassion fatigue fairly easily, not to mention just being bled to death.
And there's no shame in that, is there? We get there, don't we? Sometimes, you know, you try your best and you can't sustain it. It's all too much. You know, the news is too much, or the watching somebody repeat the same painful behaviour in their life is too much. But it's what you do then. It's what you do in response to that. And when you step back, how you look at what's actually happening. Because I suppose one of the tendencies is for people to strike out at that point, or close down and become cynical and say, it's all too much.
I think I'm seeing it as a little less drastic, almost, that it's just awareness, opening yourself to awareness of how other beings are suffering, existing, and an acceptance of that as well. I mean, I suppose sometimes you'll intervene, but mostly you're allowing yourself to acknowledge all the suffering and the things that you can't change, as well as maybe figuring out a few things that you can, and that is part of the task, to find those things. Both types of things, what you can change and what you can't change.
Yeah, that's like that serenity prayer.
Yeah.
Actually, sounds a bit like that.
It does.
One of the things that I've noticed is that how I stand in relation to other people's confusion tells me quite a lot about how I'm doing. I once went to a seminar with Shimasini. It was like a couple of days, and it was great. I mean, Shimasini was an amazing person. But there was this one bit in it where a guy stood up. It was at Cambridge University in England, and lots of people with quite strong egos in the room, lots of academic pride in the room. And he was really masterful at handling this. A lot of people wanted to expound, and he just let them. Completely benevolent, almost priestly thing going on. But there was one bit where this guy went on a long ramble, which concluded with, "Seamus Heaney, you are confused, your poetry's confused," in a certain way. And it was really fantastic, as Seamus Heaney just kind of took him in and said to him, maybe so, but confusion is not a dishonourable position. And it was one of the best things I'd ever heard.
That's
I was
beautiful.
Like, you're a genius. Like, confusion is not a dishonourable position. And I noticed that, like, when I react to people quite often when they're behaving foolishly, or I experience what they're doing is painful, or I can see that it hurts them or causes suffering all around, I notice quite often that I can't handle their confusion. And actually, in a certain way, that means I can't handle my own. Because when I'm reacting, I'm confused. Mm-hmm. I'm not seeing them clearly. I'm not seeing the conditions clearly. And I'm not seeing the complexity of my own situation clearly. And I like to remember that. Their confusion is not dishonourable. It's not just mine. Their confusion is not dishonourable. It doesn't excuse things. It doesn't excuse bad behaviour. But it's impossible for me to feel meta if I can't empathise. And if I'm reacting, I can't empathise. Ergo, I'm confused.
Doesn't take much to confuse me anyway. I'm good with confusion.
You're a pro.
He's found the high honor of fusion.
Yeah.
Well, the essence of all art and literature to some degree is confusion. It's like to be or not to be, that great sentence in Shakespeare. I mean, what can be more confusing than trying to figure that out? It's interesting, though, are you intolerant of people's confusion? Were you sharing that? Were you judging, or were you just scared of it?
I think generally...
Or did you want to resolve it?
Well, I think working through the tension is the spiritual work. So to be or not to be is a great question, because there's a sense of a vast, undiscovered country in the space that you can work through, and presumably Shakespeare and anybody else working in that tension produces the art. I think spiritual life is akin to art in that sense. I don't think I'm a particularly intolerant person, but I notice when I can step back from my reactivity, which is definitely not always in the moment, it sometimes takes some time, that whether it's anxiety or fear or just some kind of vague discomfort that I'm not even clear what it is, the root of reactivity to somebody else's confusion and behaviour and the nexus of things that goes along with it, sorrow and suffering and all the rest, it gives me good data. Is that thing again? There is no excuse for reacting to people. You know, somebody said you don't get a day off in the spiritual life. There is no excuse for reacting. I mean, your own confusion is not dishonourable, but it's interesting that Shimasini didn't say it's honourable. He says just not dishonourable. I suppose it depends what you do again in the face of it.
I'm suitably confused.
No. In a bad way or a good way.
It's okay.
Sangra Akshita once said to somebody, they asked him what he thought of "I'm okay, you're okay" as a kind of motto, and he said, no, it's "I'm not okay, you're not okay, but that's okay."
That's so great.
Well, today I actually went through all five stages in the traditional way. with the intention of doing so,
mm-hmm.
waiting to get to the fifth stage where I put them all together. And I kind of visualize that. We are all together in a big hug. And everything's okay. And everybody is okay with everybody. There's something different for me.
Yeah.
Rather than separate them all out and segregate them and just thought, well, me and the world will be happy and them too. Or I just, I didn't get to the world to maybe the last second. But I stayed with all the people and the group, the present group here. Yeah. So that was kind of a, yeah, new experience for me. I think I said before, Metta-Bhava is not my favorite. I told Naroda about that one day. He says, good, we're going to do a double one today. Yeah. Neat. Yeah.
I tried to do something similar, but it was holding hands instead of a hug. Yeah. And then I started rearranging people, and I had to stop that right away. Who's going to hold whose hand?
Yeah.
And then moved on to a bigger world.
Yeah.
I try a hug next time.
Texas hug.
Hmm?
A Texas hug.
What's a Texas hug?
Everybody just hugs into the middle.
A huddle.
Like a huddle.
Oh, okay. Yeah. They call that a Texas hug?
That's the term I heard. Huh.
Okay.
It depends on how you define they.
They.
I would find it quite hard to focus today in meditation, partly because it was the last one. I think sometimes structure freaks me out a little bit. Like the end of a week, I know it's the end of a week, so there's a certain kind of heightened awareness somehow of that that interferes with the experience. But at a certain point in the middle of the meditation when I was really not very concentrated, I suddenly got this overwhelming sense of like rejoicing in a particular person. Just, and I imagined telling her in my head and I started crying. I mean, not a huge amount, but I was like, it was so, it's quite a while since I last had kind of tears of joy or something.
Mm.
And I was completely taken aback by it. And spent much of the meditation afterwards just kind of going, whoa, where did that come from? But it was kind of nice. It was like,
yeah.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
It's not my usual meditation experience, I have to stress, but, you know, it was really good. And also strange how the mind works, because I guess we have this structured practice where you do the stages and you have a technique for focusing and bringing yourself back. And there you go, I was completely scattered all over the place. But then something non-linear came out of the primordial soup of my consciousness. And, you know.
I kept getting very concrete, thinking about the neutral person and then the leaves in our mutual yards. And just really specific things. And then I'd erase it and something else very specific would come up, my gutters. Anyway, I guess that's usual, but it just seemed more concrete than usual.
Well, I've added something to my walking about practice when I'm out and about. I carry doggy treats with me now. So I get introduced to myself to more dogs and know their names. There's one in particular, that's Lucas. And the other day the owner says, you're the only person who stops to say hi to Lucas.
That's great.
So, yeah, I like dogs. I like animals. I've always preferred animals to human beings. They're always forgiving. They're always loving. They don't seem to have all these judgments that we have created. Yeah. But I'm getting to a point in life where I can appreciate people more.
Hmm.
Now, for many years I didn't like people as a class. They were really pain. But through Buddhism I've gotten to enjoy people more.
Maybe you need people treats in your other pocket.
Good idea.
Why just show up?
That's plenty.
That's a treat.
That's the people treat. And it always works. Oh, I don't want to go. I can't be bothered. And then I end up going. Oh, hi, I'm here. Yeah, just show up. And it's always leave with a positive experience.
Yeah.
Just show up.
Yeah, resistance is good data as well, isn't it? You feel resistance to engaging with people, with living beings, when you experience resistance.
Mm-hmm.
It's good data.
I think engaging in this week and coming 5 days in a row and sitting, which I haven't done for a long time, resulted in me accepting an obligation I was sure I was going to deny, which is taking care of someone else's dog interminably until that person has a place for this dog in Los Angeles. And I was sure she was going to have to find another home for this dog. Mm-hmm. By yesterday, I decided, no, he's living with me. He's comfortable here. He's very old. He would be upset if he had to move again. It's not that much burden. And my reaction was more to feeling taken advantage of than it was to not wanting a dog. And I think meditation helped me come to that and open to this other creature.
Brilliant.
So I thank this week for that, if nothing else I can put my hands around yet.
Mm. That's really good. That's really good, because in a way you might be being taken advantage of, but actually that doesn't matter. Because, you know, the meta practice is yours. The dog's objective is a living being.
Exactly.
So, but as complex as that, somebody might be taking advantage of you, it's whether you mind. It's really great.
It's kind of comical when scenarios like that happen where you're being taken advantage of, but it doesn't matter because what you're doing and what's happening is what really matters. And if you have a tendency to focus on that, you miss the whole point. But it's so neat.
The thing we talked about yesterday, the Tibetan mind trainings, you know, the thing about seeing people as your teacher when they're difficult, they do a good thing where they say, may they have the victory. You give the victory to the other person.
Mm-hmm.
In any situation where somebody's asserting over you or manipulating or all that difficult stuff, like, you have a practice of giving other people the victory, which is really difficult, really difficult. And every time I come up against a situation where that sort of thing would be required, I always find myself, as soon as I remember it, give the other person the victory, there's a legal department in my head somewhere tries to find an out.
Legal department.
You know, furiously trying to work out why in this case this is probably an exception. I don't need to give
you really need the victory this time.
I was able to do that with my chosen enemy, was a former boss, and I was actually able to see that as a woman being in place over men who were of a military background, that, and this was 30 years ago, 20 years ago, I was able to give her the victory, that she did it, even though it wasn't to my satisfaction. I give her victory. That was a relief.
Well, hey, listen, we're coming up on time, so should we all, one last chance, what's your takeaway from the week? That was a good segue in, Kathy. What's the takeaway from the week? Doing metta practice, talking about metta practice every day.
For me, to appreciate the metta practice more than I had.
Besides the dog, it was discovering the Portsmouth Buddhist Center, which I hope to have more of a relationship with. Maybe even learn how to pronounce some of the words.
Well, it was great to do the metta practice every day. Usually I don't do it so often. I really loved the talks, listening to the talks online, of Vasantra's talks, and then everything that came up here just seemed to create so many more doorways into doing this practice. So I feel it's just been such a rich time of work, of deepening the work on that practice. So it's been great. And having two new people join, that's really exciting. So
I had the best meditation I've had in many years yesterday. Today was good, but yesterday just really felt like I was working much harder at acceptance, kindness, and that it was working. It was helping.
Great. Yeah, similarly to all of that, I've just had a really good week doing this, not without resistance at the start of the week. I'm very busy and the urban retreat's very full on, and I've got another department that I was trying to find a reason why I don't need to get up in the morning and come and lead meditation and then do podcasting. But actually, it's been really great, really enriching. I feel much better at this end of the week than I did at the other end, which is a good sign that it's working. And really delightful just to get to know all of you, actually, new people and not so new people. Just, it's a lot of sharing. Really amazed at how open you've all been. So Thanks very much. I'm sure people out there really appreciate it who've been listening.
Well, thank you for creating the space to do this.
You're most welcome.
Thank you.
So that's us, folks. That's us for our little... What's the best word? What's
good? Gang. I like gang.
Gang, our little crew, our the good ship Portsmouth Buddhist Centre sailing off after its journey to the Isle of Meta. Oh, gosh, that's terrible.
Which department is going to edit that?
I don't know, yeah. I'll probably be fired.
I don't think meta-analysis.
I'll probably be fired for that. We'll be back with Buddhist Centre Online podcast via Audioboo and iTunes and everywhere else. Anon, in the meantime, if you'd like to get more resources on the Metta Bhavana, the development of loving kindness, you can go to thebuddhistcentre.com/urban-retreat and follow the group. We'll make it an archive soon so that everybody can access all of the major resources there. Take care, everybody. I hope the Urban Retreat ends well for you if you're doing it. May you all be well.